and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. NATO's Ukraine proxy war on Russia should have never happened. Before the conflict, there were options. A month into the conflict, there were options to end it. The West refused to negotiate. Now, ending this conflict is proving most difficult. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Nikolai Petro in Kingston. He is professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island. And in Brussels, we cross to Gilbert Doctorow. He is an independent political analyst and author of Memoirs of an Expat Manager in Moscow during the 1990s. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Nikolai, recently you wrote a very, very interesting article, I thought quite provocative and compelling in many ways, titled, What's Next for Ukraine? The Outlines of a Peaceful Settlement. Can you... This is hard to do in television. It's better to do in print. But can you give us the main contours of what a peaceful settlement would be?
Well, I think there's a general agreement among analysts that this war is not going to be won by Ukraine. Ukraine, therefore, needs to seek a settlement. The outlines of this settlement were already reached in March and April of 2022. And they basically boil down to an exchange of security for land. The issue then remains of guaranteeing the rights of the Russian minority, Russian-speaking minority in Ukraine. And I think that can be done by adhering to the stipulations of the Ukrainian constitution and should be made a requirement for EU admission for Ukraine, to which Russia, by the way, according to President Putin, has never objected.
Okay, but, you know, Gilbert, you know, as we are convening here, the Wall Street Journal is running an article titled EU Officials Fear Ukraine Military Collapse. So a lot of this talk is kind of academic, and no offense to academics like our guest here, but facts on the ground are coming apace, aren't they, here? I mean, if we see what's going on in the U.S. Congress, it looks like the GOP in the House is not in any rush to help out Ukraine, which the Ukrainians have admitted that they're completely dependent on Western aid right now. So talking about a settlement is actually quite germane. Go ahead, Gilbert.
The talk about a settlement is entirely between Washington and Washington.
Yep.
There is the assumption that whenever Washington gives a wink and a come hither gesture of its fingers, Moscow will obey and will be pleased to be considered as a talking partner. That is, nothing could be further from the truth. The issue that we're discussing today has been virtually a daily subject of discussion on the talk shows that Russian state television features 5 days, 6 days a week, and which are widely watched. And these talk shows have been, to my estimation, in the past few weeks, going very much in line with what you can imagine is going on every time that Russians in their apartments or dachas break bread with friends. These are the most important and topical questions. Can there be a peace, and should there be a peace whenever Washington says, come hither? The consensus that I see is no way. That fooled once, okay, fooled twice, but fooled three times, Russia will not be fooled three times. And the notion that that there can be a settlement utilizing the terms of the Ukrainian constitution to protect the rights of minorities, for which minorities? Okay. It's not just Russian minorities, but Hungarian minorities, Romanian minorities, who are all treated to the same very cruel terms that the Russian speakers have experienced. Would the EU be able to enforce such demands on Ukraine that it honor its constitution and honor the general rules of humane practices and give a proper freedom of expression, of education, and so forth to its Russian-speaking minority? No way. We've been through Minsk II. It brought us nothing. The EU itself is not a proper enforcer of these rights of minorities. Within the EU, the rights of, just to look at the Russian case, Russian-speaking minorities are trampled on and have been trampled on since before 2004, when the Baltic states were admitted. Everyone knew then that these states were in strict violation of the rules within the EU for admission based on their protection of minorities.
Gilbert, yeah. You have to add on. I'll throw it to Nikolai right now. Is that we've had this intense Ukrainianization of culture, of language. I mean, and you know, I don't, you know, I can mention, you know, kind of the Banderite ideology here. But only in the last couple of news cycles, there are no Russian speakers in Ukraine. They don't exist. I mean, how do you deal with a government like that? Okay, I mean, and it's all fueled on by Western officials and money. I mean, the problem is that I want peace as much as anyone else. I really do. But how do you talk to people like that, say, there aren't any Russian speakers in Ukraine? It's absurd. Nikolai.
I agree with all the points made, and yet the outcome inevitably is the same, namely that a negotiated settlement will have to be reached. That doesn't mean that one side or the other doesn't claim victory. In fact, the victory is most likely to go to Russia, which means that the terms of settlement will be defined largely by Russia. But nevertheless, a settlement it'll be, and it'll be a negotiated settlement. With whom, that's a matter that will no doubt evolve over time. Whether Zelensky is that person, it looks increasingly, but this is purely speculation, that it might not be. We could speculate endlessly about who his replacement might be. It's likely that a successor to Zelensky will do exactly what Zelensky did to Poroshenko and Poroshenko did to his predecessor, which is to run as the peace candidate. Now, at that point, Russia will still have to negotiate the terms of its settlement, assuming it's victorious. And there will be some sort of adaptations and some sort of quid pro quo in order to achieve Russia's security objectives.
That's the most important thing. That is by far the most important thing. And go back to Gilbert in Brussels. Why should Russia go to the table right now? Why? Okay, because, you know, Russia is not interested in negotiating Minsk III, okay? So, and that's, the West is always going to do that. NATO's always going to do that. Buy time until they can do it again. Go ahead, Gilbert.
Well, first, I'd like to ask, what do we mean by Russia? And here I introduce an angle that I think my colleague Nikolai will find attractive. That is taking a lesson from literature and from the arts. The literature that I want to bring in is not Greek classics, but Russian classics. To be precise, Lev Tolstoy, War and Peace, and its prologue. The prologue is maybe 100 pages long, and it deals with a question that's very topical today and has to do with the very question you've posed, Peter. That is, who runs the show? Is it the great men in history, the leaders, who are making decisions that have great consequences for their countries in the world? Or are they the expression, the implement, the tool, one might say, of the national will? And here in the West, it's assumed that Russia means one man, Putin. We all know he's a dictator. We all know the dictators control everything that 145 million people under them do, and so forth. That is quite nonsense, but it's the kind of fairy tale that is the mainstream understanding of how the world works. It doesn't work that way in Russia, as it does anywhere. Mr. Putin is, in many respects, helps formulate Russian policy, but he also is an expression of the will of the people. And the will of the people today in Russia, by that I mean primarily the elites, is very much against sitting down at the table with anyone coming from Kiev. Yeah. Because the equal question applies to Kiev. Who runs the show? I don't think anyone believes that Zelensky runs the show, or that Zaluzhny would run the show, or that Arestovych would run the show. there is a group, a clique, you call them neo-Nazis, the label isn't important, but there is a clique of people who were responsible for the coup d'etat of February 2014, who are still calling the shots, and that's the issue for Russia, how those people can be removed from power if there's to be a negotiated settlement. But let's take a step back. Negotiated settlement, why? Well, it is even in the Bild article of last Friday, in which was discussing a secret agreement between Biden and Scholz that they would cut back on arms deliveries to Ukraine and try to pressure Mr. Zelensky to go to his people and to call for their approval.
Well, I'm sorry, Gilbert. Yeah. That's just kabuki theater. I mean, Biden can call Zelensky right now. Let me go to Nikolai. Call him right now and tell him what to do. I mean, again, you know, nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine. This is all nonsense. It's nonsense. Go ahead, Nikolai.
We can rely on all leaders, including Ukrainian leaders, to struggle for their own personal survival.
Sure.
And their own interests. One of the leading opposition papers, now managed outside of Ukraine, but widely read still in Ukraine, argued, or pointed out, I should say, that there's been a great impoverization of Ukraine, but at the very tops, people have managed very well, and indeed are making money hand over fist through the system of bribes.
All right, I want to deal with corruption after our break here. We're going to have to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Let's go back to Nikolai in Kingston. Let's finish up on this point on corruption, because this is something that, you know, in the very beginning, I warned very, very clearly, this is, you know, you're only making it worse, the corruption in Ukraine, and it was very bad. And prior to the conflict, that was a talking point. Ukraine's one of the most corrupt countries in the world. And then for about a year, you couldn't say it. And then suddenly you could start saying it because they really were getting their money's worth, meaning the taxpayers in the West here. There's going to be a reckoning with that. I mean, I've often surmised that even if there is a settlement, there's going to be a lot of people being held account or should be held account in Ukraine. Where did all that money actually go?
Well, we'll probably never know for sure, since even the Pentagon can't do an audit.
Yeah, they can't even do an audit themselves, yeah.
True. But I did want to get to reiterate the point that there will be negotiations between Moscow and Ukraine for any settlement of this war, for any ceasefire, for any armistice, any step along the way will require negotiations. And I have little doubt that people will step forward, whether they want to or not, whether simply because the field of people above them has been abandoned and everyone else has left and they're the only ones left to hold the bag. Nevertheless, there will be people with whom these negotiations will be undertaken. Of course, they will be in a weaker position because they will, to the extent that they're interested in reaching any accord with Russia, they will be abandoned by the West. And as a result, they will have little choice but to concede to Russia's demands. My warning, however, to Russia is that we all have something to lose here.
Okay.
It is quite possible that Russia will push too far, demand too much, move forward even too quickly into territories that it really does not want in Ukraine, and therefore opening itself up to counterstrikes and moves and more military stalemate. So there's danger on all sides to be aware of.
That's such a good point. And I think I'm pretty sure both of you read an article written by John Mearsheimer recently. And he comes to what kind of settlement will it be? Well, he believes, like we all do, that Russia is going to win, but it will be an ugly peace, which I thought was a very interesting way of describing it, Gilbert. I don't think that Russia has maximalist views here, but the word has already been mentioned on this program. It will solve a lot of problems. Finally, take seriously Russia's security demands. The rest of it, believe it or not, can be a detail, just details. But Russia wants its security respected. And I think from that point, things could actually end reasonably easily and magnanimously. Gilbert.
For it to end magnanimously, there would have to be people up to it on the Ukrainian and on the U.S. sides. So I don't see such people exist. But I didn't get a chance to quite finish the remark about the Bild article. They have agreed that if Ukraine cannot hold up its end and enter into negotiations, then they would be content with a frozen conflict. The idea of a frozen conflict has been floated in the United States repeatedly over the last month or two, and it's dealt with as if it's a natural thing to happen, because we all know that they are at an impasse and that no one has won the war. Well, that observation is strictly one of the Washington line. It doesn't correspond to reality on the ground, and it has beneath it, or behind it, a concept of what the war is about, which is in no way taking into account Russia's own definition of its objectives, not America's definition of what its objectives should be. And its own definition of objectives are to destroy the Ukrainian armed forces and not to seize territory. This is not a territorial war from the Russian perspective. And from their perspective, they are winning wonderfully, because they are, in fact, destroying the manpower reserves of the Ukrainian army. So they would be content, I believe, with a frozen conflict, but not at the point that Washington thinks it will take. The frozen conflict from the Moscow perspective would be one in which Russia takes Odessa, moves up to Transnistria, and closes Ukraine from the Black Sea, essentially leaving the country handicapped, if not a failed state, to fall into the hands of the EU and to be massively subsidized forever by the EU. That would suit Russia fine. The main issue, as the EU have said repeatedly, is Russian security. And that will depend not on a signed peace treaty. It will depend on the facts on the ground, that Ukraine's borders are sufficiently far, that Ukraine's military potential is sufficiently handicapped, that the West is perfectly understanding that an attempt to install missiles and other military equipment threatening Russia will meet with a response that is devastating, perhaps not just on Ukrainian territory, but back in Germany or wherever else this equipment is coming from. So Russia will look after its own security, and it doesn't need a security guarantee from the United States or EU to protect itself.
Well, I mean, security doesn't happen in a vacuum, and this segues perfectly to where I wanted to go. Nikolai, as the three of us, very rationally and I think compassionately, all of us want this to come to an end, to stop the killing. But, you know, we have next year the 75th anniversary of NATO, okay? And they're coming up with, you know, little magical ideas how to kind of twist and turn, and, you know, we could slip them in this way, slip them in that way. I mean, it's quite grotesque, okay? Because even Stoltenberg, the Secretary General, admitted off the cuff or by mistake, I don't know, that yes, NATO expansion was the origins of this conflict. But they're still talking about NATO expansion. I mean, where do these people come from, and what do they want to achieve?
Well, NATO has the purpose of expanding NATO.
Okay, there you go. That's their mission, right? Yes, okay.
Well, it's just, it suffices for survival and funding. But I think a rump Ukrainian state without an outlet to the Black Sea would leave a territory that is sizable attached to NATO, and that would be revanchist in nature, and that would be dangerous to Russia in perpetuity. It's one of the reasons in 1916 why Prime Minister Durnova said we should not annex Galicia in a memo to Tsar Nicholas II because we would not gain anything from it. And one of the wisest things I've read is that Russia has no interest culturally, historically, or in terms of security to annex regions that do not want to be part of it or could not, in a reasonable amount of time, be pacified and where the majority would not be comfortable being part of Russia. And I'm afraid that much of Western and even now Central Ukraine falls into that category. That territory and its relationship to Russia and to and to Europe, that still has to be negotiated. And that is, in fact, the central point that will have to be negotiated in any larger pan-European security arrangement, which should be, at this point, already in sight as part of our objectives.
Well, what we just heard from Nikolai is possible, but if that's the goal that they want to achieve. I differ slightly with you, but I think at the end of the day, Russia has its security interests at heart. That's its number one issue here. How that is translated into policy in dealing with the neighborhood can go in different directions here. But, I mean, I'm not sure NATO is interested in security in Europe. And now, the difference is now is that Russia is the official enemy. Remember, we're just a defensive alliance. Russia is not, you know, our enemy. Well, all that has changed right now, and Russia has to keep an eye on NATO, considering it's already expanded during this conflict. Go ahead, Gilbert.
Yes, the expansion of NATO that we've seen since the admission of the Baltic states has been counterproductive for the security of Europe. I think I used to correspond very closely with Steve Cohen, and he was saying that NATO is not a fraternity club at a university. It's the idea of admitting new members should be conditioned on one question: will this increase or decrease the security of the existing members? And it is patently clear. It became actionable only several years after the fact that admitting the Baltic states was a big negative for security of the existing members. This so is true for admitting Finland with its 1,200-kilometer-long border that's to be defended by a population of 9 million. It's absurd. It can only be a detract from the security of Europe. Now, I don't think the Russians would be too put out if NATO brought into it a rump Ukraine that is some distance from where the Ukrainian borders were before all this war began. The fact that Brussels would be controlling the otherwise insane people running Ukraine and preventing them from triggering a pan-European, if not global, war, I think that in itself would be a positive. But only after Ukraine has been so reduced in size and in population that and removed at a greater distance from Russia's borders. Under those conditions, I think Russia could live with a NATO member Ukraine. NATO members
let me add last 30 else. Seconds to Nikolai. React to what we just heard from Gilbert. 30 seconds. Go ahead.
I think that effectively transforms Belarus into the buffer state that Russia's looking for.
Well, that's keep going.
I just think it closes some problems, but it raises others. And issues still need to be comprehensively addressed.
We need another Helsinki process, okay? That's what we need right now. Rapidly, I'm running out of time. I want to remind our viewers, Nikolai's essay is What's Next for Ukraine? The Outlines for a Peaceful Settlement. You can find it at antiwar.com. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Brussels and in Kingston. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.